You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Marina Adams in New York. Marina, thank you so much for being with me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
So I want to talk about your work that you've done and a book collaboration that you've done, but perhaps I know that you just came back from Japan. If we can start there, how was your trip to Japan?
Oh, it was extraordinary, really, on so many levels, but particularly as a visual artist, it's extremely rich. The culture is so layered and, I guess, textured, and the considerations are so many that it was, as I say, just an extremely rich visual experience, and not just visual, because the food also is extraordinary, both visually and taste and nutrition, I think, too.
And I've never been to Japan, so, you know, I mean, as an artist, what was happening visually? I mean, I always think of Japan as, the prince that we know and all kinds of things, but also this kind of minimalist aesthetic that's quite different than a European other Asian aesthetic. What did you find there that was kind of visually arresting? Is there any examples that you could give me?
Well, you know, if I can put it into language, I think that it's the transitions that they are capable of making in terms of, for instance, weight. To move from a stone and to be sensitive in so many ways as to the shape and the surface and the placement and the size of a stone, to transition immediately, for instance, into sand or moss, or a tree, a branch, what air is, you know, what drawing is. It's all really, as I say, textured and specific and subtle and sensitive. And that's why I say for an artist, it's a very rich way to, I guess, to live, to experience. And in a way, I don't know if it echoes what you do in the studio as a painter, but it definitely, as I say, I felt very nourished. One thing I can say, you know, about the food, too, is that the portions were often many, but also very small. But the way they're presented is, it's so particular and so visual that you're really nourished in many ways, and I found that very interesting, that I felt that the kind of nourishment you get is not just the literal filling up of your stomach. It's much larger than that.
Gosh, I you know, that reminds me of a friend who was a poet, and she was writing about, I think it's called a obento box or a bento box. It's kind of the school lunch that you'd pack for your child, and she was looking at pictures of Japanese school lunches and kind of making reference to, I wish I was nourished like that, not so much with the food, but it was gorgeous looking, you know, and that kind of love that must have gone into it, as well as aesthetic kind of preparation and, you know, let alone the taste, seemed like nothing she'd ever seen. And it's like nothing I've ever seen or experienced, I don't think.
Yeah, that's great, too, that you bring up love. definitely. Definitely.
And the whole and visually, was there art there or sculpture? I mean, you're talking about approaches to things, but was there a particular artist or place you were in that's
well,
memorable?
Actually, yeah, there were two exhibitions, in fact, that I saw that were somehow perfect for me. One was of Shunga, the erotic prince, which I have appropriated from in the past. So that was very interesting. I knew a lot of the work, but there was also work that I hadn't known, so that was very rich. And, of course, the funny thing really was that they said it was the first time this work had been exhibited in Japan. I think it was even organized in Britain, But it was very dense. The lines were long. Well, the lines weren't long to get in, but the lines were very slow. I think everyone was reading everything, and they were very slow. But it did make me laugh that there were probably a disproportionate number of older Japanese men there, which I thought was kind of funny. Usually you go to the museums and see shows, and it's disproportionately women. But with the Shunga, it was at least mixed, and certainly a lot of men. And the other exhibition up now is of Nikita St. Saul, which was a collect. She had a Japanese collector who had bought a lot of work, and so that was also interesting. And that, you know, those were the two museum shows. And then outside of that, it was mostly, as I say, the gardens and the, of course, the shrines and the temples. But the places that I found to be most interesting to me were the places that were more somehow involved with a meditative space as opposed to, let's say, a religious space. These places had, as I say, extraordinary sensitivity to either sand drawings or, you know, as I say, just the trees, just the whole landscape architecture was really incredible.
So let's move to your current work. So you're back, and what are you working on now? I want to talk about your book too, but what is the current work that you're involved in?
Well, I'm just back, and you know, I can't wait to get working on some large paintings, and I'm going to do a series of prints too, which I'm excited about. And I guess I can speak about, I mean, the thing that I think a lot about, and especially coming back from, I guess, from this trip, which was so visually satiating, is about where the intellect in the visual is and where the intellect in art is. It's something that I think is important to try to, I don't know if you can find language, but to try to at least address, because especially in abstract art, I think without a narrative, you know, without a storyline, sometimes it's more difficult for people to find their way into it. And and I guess I think about it as being, and I've said about the voice itself, there's something about, you know, it's like bird song, and that how we communicate in a visual way, you know, without language. And it's not just abstract art, because if you think about, for instance, Cézanne, I mean, Cézanne isn't really, you can say Cézanne's about apples, but he's not really about apples, right? It goes to a whole other place, it's really about a depth of thought, I guess you can say.
Well, this is really interesting, and of course a very difficult thing to talk about, and I'd like to kind of struggle to talk about that, because we're talking or approaching these kind of wordless qualities of art, of great art, of good art too, you know, that are entering into our intellect, as I'm hearing you say, but they're often not something you can pinpoint or talk about, but they're engaging us. I mean, you know, some people have talked about some color field painters as kind of spiritual or, you know, meditative or something like that, which are all kind of approximations of what they are. But I remember when I first saw Joseph Albers' painting, and it was really the first thing that turned me on to art. And my mother was saying, look at the edges, you know, of the colors. And, you know, there are things that begin appearing that aren't immediately there when you first look at it. And it stunned me. And I mean, when you talk about engaging the intellect, is that the kind of thing you're talking about or without a narrative or is it a meditative experience?
Yeah. I mean,
this is hard to work.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting you bring up edges. I think about, you know, I think about edges, of course, when you work. Or I guess I don't, it's not so much thinking as it is recognizing. You know, I think a lot of what it is for me is about recognizing things as opposed to thinking things. you know, it's not that there aren't ideas in the work, and it's not that I don't have ideas, but the work isn't led by ideas. The work is really led by, I think, obviously I've developed a structure, I've developed something that has to do with and utilizes, for instance, patterning and color. And, of course, you know, you have to work on basic things, structure and scale. But it's really ultimately about being receptive and sensitive and recognizing things. And I think that that's very important because life is really all about recognizing things. In fact, it's funny, going back to Japan, there was a great, wonderful place we went to in Kitakamakura, it was called, and they gave us a little sort of slip of paper, and it talked about, a little story about a spoon. And it talks about how the spoon is soaked in soup many times a day, but it itself can't understand the taste of the soup. Unlike our tongue, which even with a drop gives us a complete idea, right, of what taste is. But this is just a metaphor to say that, you know, you can read lots of books or you can go to the best schools, whatever, but that's not, if you're not sensitive, if you don't recognize things, if you don't pay attention to how things are connected, for instance, then, you really don't learn anything. You know, it's kind of valueless. You sort of remain the spoon, is the story. And I think about that, you know, studio.
I like that. That's a kind of beautiful analogy. And in talking about some of your work specifically, you know, the work Weeping Woman 2 or the peace paintings from this year, a lot of those, though they're entirely abstract, when I read those titles, like Weeping Woman, I see, you know, an eye or what seems like an eye, and I kind of am also creating a bit of a narrative. The same with a peace sign. It doesn't quite look like a peace sign, but then I'm investing something in it to try to find that or decipher that. Is that part of what you're thinking? I mean, I know the title isn't the work, but it seems to kind of read the work in a sense.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I do, and I think I've been, you know, as your years add up in terms of working, I think I have been more successful, and definitely I try to use language. I try to sort of lead into a space. I guess I think of it as a space for thought without, and I've said this before, without dictating thought, you can lead into a space, and I do that. Again, the piece paintings, the language usually follows the work. I did a painting, one of the small paintings, and in fact, I started them after seeing a show of tantric art at Feature Gallery, Feature Inc., by the late Hudson. It really, I guess, influenced, and I started to work on them. And then one of them, it was almost like the peace sign kind of appeared, and so that, again, led me to the language. The Weeping Women series, I'm working on another book that is called Portrait in a Dream, which hopefully will come out next year. But that is a more, I guess, project-oriented body of work that came out of two postcards, one of Picasso's, a study for the Guernica of the Weeping Woman that had been paired with a postcard of the head of the St. Teresa in Ecstasy by Bernini. I lived in Rome for quite a few years. Anyway, these two worked together, somehow created a whole. And, they were on my studio wall for a number of years before I recognized that I wanted to do something with them. So that body of work does come out of those influences. And so I try not to limit. I let the work come out of wherever it can come.
And what will the next book be about? How are you approaching the book that may come out next year? Is that are you working with a poet? And I want to talk about the past book too, but how is that being put together?
I did a number of I did quite a few works where I'm literally pairing I guess I'm making a work that each work is has two elements, I guess. One that comes out of the figurative, the head, in a sense, and the notion of the suffering female, and the other is, I guess, more abstract, and is the other half, which is the ecstasy. So I guess I used the postcards and have developed works on paper that are twofold, and so the book is really about each spread will be a pair of works that become one.
It's an entirely visual book. There's no text in there.
Yeah, the only text is I had sent some of the images. I did want language, but again, I didn't want, and this will bring me back to the book that was just published. But anyway, I sent some of the images to Charles Bernstein, the poet, who's a friend, and I don't know. Months later, I get an email with a poem, a really gorgeous poem called "Her Ecstasy Is Abstract," and I'm going to include it in the book. And that brings me to the book that was just published by Litmus Press. It's called Actualities, and it's with the poet Norma Cole.
Wait a minute. Before we talk about that book, and I want to talk about it, that's very interesting, the one you're talking about. You're pairing suffering and ecstasy, in a sense, in these. Is that correct? Because that's sort of a fascinating pairing as well. And so in a way, this is about a very sensual and perhaps human kind of form. I mean, we've been talking about there not being narrative so much in this, but pairing those things which are, you know, in themselves abstract concepts, are somehow about a woman's life, isn't it? Or the life of women, or the life of humans. Am I reading too much into that, or is that part of your intention?
Yeah, I absolutely. And that's why I bring up even the, I was almost, I don't know, I guess ironic is the wrong word, but the fact that when I was in Japan, that there was both an exhibition of Shunga, which was, you know, it's overtly sexual, but it's just erotic is what it is. And then Nikki de St. Phalle, on the other hand, who also talks about, you know, I mean, she ended up working and choosing, like the painter, one of my favorite painters, Alma Thomas, choosing to work out of, you can say, the ecstasy, but she acknowledges the suffering. And, in this, I guess in every day and age, but certainly in this time, there's so much suffering. How can we, you know, how do you deal with that? How does one deal with that? How do you deal with that in the studio without necessarily being a, I guess, getting literal or, you know, being sort of a social worker? Because we have to do, and we have to do what we do, and we have to work in our form. But it is important to deal with that reality that is many people's reality right now.
Absolutely, and it's something that, you know, we can all relate to on some level, which, you know, makes it this kind of universal experience that's probably needed to continue to share. And so let's talk about the book that you were just about to mention, that you previously made.
Oh, it's called Actualities, as I said. It's the poet is Norma Cole, who's based in San Francisco. We've known each other a long time, and this is the, I guess we've said, the fullest expression of work. And what's great is that Well, we wrote a little bit about the collaboration in the back of it, but mostly the book is a pairing of my work and her work, so poems and both line drawings and gouaches. So there's both color and line. And as I say, what's great is that neither one really illustrates the other, but they really they communicate together, I think. I think that one expands the other. I'll read there. Actually, we got both Susan Howe and Barry Schwabsky to write blurbs, and they're quite beautiful. Susan Howe writes at the end, she says, "Together, lines and images carry a reader's eye out as if to see, then fold back on each other like waves." Okay, that was...
That's lovely. That's lovely.
Yeah.
And is there other text in the book? There's also, you said, Barry Schwabsky, and is there any other text in there?
No, we just got two blurbs for the back, and then, as I say, the poems are by the poet and the drawings are by the painter, and they lie next to each other, and I think the way they talk to each other is very interesting. It's very abstract, and in that respect, you have to just relax. You just have to relax, and you just have to enjoy it, I guess.
Well, it's such an interesting process, because I would imagine, like the titles that you even put on works, when we read a poem next to a work, even though, as you're saying, it's not illustrative of the work, somehow we're making connections, and almost like what you just read, you know, we're pulling things out of it to... I'm not sure what that experience is, but we somehow try to make it work in some sense. Do you know what I mean? We try to figure out why those things are together.
Yeah, and in fact, the best, I guess, the most magical part was the pairing, was the organization. I ended up doing 100 works, and obviously I had to cull them down. And the fun and the magic of it was really finding the visual images that somehow really spoke and related to the language, the lines of language, and you know, which spoke to which, and that, you know, hopefully, I think we did a good job in terms of making those choices, and that was definitely part of the art, part of the collaboration. You know, like anything, like a show, you know, it's all a collaboration. You know, you can say.
Yeah, that's so true, and where will the work that you're doing now or any of the work you mentioned be shown next? Are you having a show coming up?
I don't have anything scheduled, but I have a lot. There are a lot of seeds planted, so we'll see. We'll see what grows.
Very good. Yeah, well, then another book's coming out, and you said you're doing more printmaking soon as well?
I'm going to do a series of prints, etchings, I think, so I'm excited about that. And particularly, as I say, coming back from Japan, I have some thoughts. I had wanted to go, but I've done ceramics too, and of course they're, you know, the ceramic arts are so strong there. But I'm going to hopefully translate everything into the prints.
And in terms of how your work, you know, interacts with the market, or really how you manage your career, do you also teach and work other places, or are you just painting full time?
No, in fact, this is the first time this semester. I think the first time since I had a child 21 years ago that I haven't taught, and. You know, I love teaching, but it is great not to as well. It's great. You know, the thing about teaching, it's not just the energy that you put out. It's the leading up to it. It's the energy, you know, thinking about going and then working, and then it's the recovery time. So it really does every week take something from you, which anyone who's involved, you know. So right now it's just been great not to have to make those weekly transitions and just to be able to focus and concentrate on the work.
And do you also still go back and forth to Italy? Because I know you were living also in Parma, weren't you?
Yeah, we have a place in the countryside, actually, outside, which I have a studio, so I work there in the summers, which is also an interesting, I guess, pairing. It took me a while to figure out how to utilize the studio, but now it's, again, sort of fallen into place, how one body of work feeds the other and how one space and one studio feeds the other, I think is working out well.
Well, it sounds like a beautiful setup and something you certainly deserve after 21 years to be between those two places and to be able to focus on your work. That sounds wonderful. So in closing, is there a place that there'll be links in this interview where people can see things, but is there anywhere you want to point people to see work? It could be the book that's online. You could mention the name of it or anywhere else you think you want to send the listeners to who are in different parts of the world.
Well, I did an exhibition over the summer in Hudson, upstate Hudson, New York, at Gallery Gris, G-R-I-S. And the book is called Actualities. You can get it through the small press distribution, Norma Cole and Marina Adams. I am going to be, the only thing, I guess, coming up is in the spring I'll be in an exhibition in London at the Camden Arts Center, and we'll see what else. We'll see what else arises.
Marina, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate your time.
I enjoyed it. Thanks a lot, Brandon.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.